Welcome to episode 163 of Practical Defense. Can versus should. Welcome to the Practical Defense Podcast, where you'll learn practical approaches to staying safe in our increasingly dangerous urban environments. I'm your host, Alex Addicks. We have another long discussion for you this week. Our topic of discussion is the decision we must make between can versus should. Just because we can do something doesn't always mean that we should do it. Paul Wilson is our guest for the discussion, and we put the subject into the context of self-defense, training, teaching, and children. If my voice sounds different this week, it's because of my cold. When Paul and I recorded the discussion, my cold was just starting to come on. And today, when I'm recording the introduction and close, I'm in the full throes of it. Ah, the joy. So before I break into a sneezing or coughing fit, let's move on to the discussion with Paul Wilson.
Gun Rights Radio Network has the best pro-Second Amendment, pro-gun rights podcast available on the net. The podcasts are absolutely free when subscribing using iTunes or Zoom Marketplace. Or if you want, you can just listen from the website. Make sure you visit gunrightsradio.com to subscribe. Podcasting freedom, one episode at a time.
You're about to learn concealed carry secrets that most Americans will never know. With your free subscription to Concealed Carry Report, you will learn how to select the best carry holster, how to know when it's okay to use deadly force, self-defense video of the week, situational awareness tips from fellow subscribers who've had to defend themselves, politically incorrect commentary, unbiased product and gear reviews. Go to www.gunrightsradio.com/USCCA and sign up for your free subscription to Conceal Carry Report.
Welcome back. Now, this week we have a special guest, Paul Wilson of Karate Cafe. Welcome, Paul.
Hey, Alex. Good to be back on the show again.
Oh, we'd love having you. It's always a lively conversation when you're on.
Well, thanks. I try and keep up my end of the, try and handle my end of the log.
Well, this week we are going to discuss can versus should. When it comes to self-defense, when it comes to training, when it comes to martial arts, there are a lot of things that you can do, but the question that's rarely asked is should you? So what we're going to do today is cover can versus should across a fairly broad spectrum. We're going to talk about martial arts. We're going to talk about personal protection. Of course, we're going to talk about firearms and even children. We're going to talk about children and what we can and should do with children when it comes to training in martial arts. So, Paul, in your studio, because you own your own dojo, there are a lot of things that you've been taught over the years. Are there things that you've decided that you've removed from the curriculum?
Well, I won't say I removed them, but I do kind of reserve techniques, and there may be, and I would say techniques, not so much concepts, because I think that a lot of the concepts that we do can be applied in a lot of different ways, which is one of the reasons why I like it. But I think that probably just the natural escalation of things I've pulled back from. I mean, I've got my youngest student is 13, and so, you know, for her, there's things that I won't teach her for a couple of reasons. One, you know, just a 13-year-old probably shouldn't know that sort of thing. Can't really count on the responsibility of them using it, although she's fairly responsible. But I don't want out there. I don't want, you know, that tool in the toolbox yet, because there's plenty of other things that she can do that are perfectly valid. But with, you know, my older students and students that have prior martial arts and stuff like that, I may demonstrate something along those lines, you know, something that, you know, could potentially hurt somebody or kill somebody. But I don't ever really, you know, wax poetic about it. And really, I haven't had a lot of people who, you know, ooh, show me how to rip their throat out or whatever. It's pretty much just like, oh, okay. And then they just kind of go on. There's nothing I've specifically removed because it's just too deadly. You know, it's an escalation. Generally, it's an escalation of whatever I'm showing them that they would come to naturally on their own, probably with a little more training. And I just don't want to really emphasize it at this point.
I've trained under two masters who were very close friends, who had very different approaches to training the martial arts. And of course, I'm referring to Grandmaster Ed Parker and Grandmaster Bong Soo Han. Grandmaster Bong Soo Han, there were over 1,000 or a couple thousand different techniques in Hapkido. When I studied under him, he had removed everything that he considered too violent or too deadly. And he changed his approach to it was very soft. It was far closer to the root of Aikido than it is to, say, a sister arts of Tang Soo Do or Taekwondo. And what he felt was that because he used to teach it, and he had actually done it when he was teaching special forces in Vietnam and presidential protection units and things like that. He said, I've seen too much death and killing. I'm not going to do it anymore. And so he removed anything that he felt was aggressive or offensive in what he taught in his version of Hapkido. On the flip side, there's Grandmaster Parker. At Yellow Belt, you're snapping people's necks. So it's like walking the front door and you're, you know, bending people over and doing a hammer fist to the back of their neck, which, if done with strength, will send a shockwave through your entire body. My current grandmaster had it happen to him a couple of times just in practice, and people hit him too hard. And he said it was like an electric shock that went to all of his limbs and he just collapsed. Done with power or excessive force, you could paralyze or kill somebody with that. And that is five swords. And when you walk in the door, it's, hi, welcome to American Kenpo. Let me teach you five swords. So Grandmaster Parker came from a street fighter background, literally on the bad side of the pineapple fields in Hawaii. And his philosophy was, it's not who's right, it's who's left. And, right. You know, better to be judged by 12 than carried by 6. And all these other real, you know, strong power macho things that I personally don't subscribe to. But I always have a problem teaching these types of techniques to people that, one, have barely been with you for very long. You really don't know them or their attitude or if they're mature enough or have a strong enough personal integrity not to turn these into turn them into a thug.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's the responsibility of any of the instructors. I can't say maybe it's ultimately your responsibility because the person who uses the technique, but there should be a certain amount of restraint for the technique that you're using. Now, you know, I mean, the way I look at it and the way we teach our system is it's, you know, there's no overt, you know, like do this, and then, you know, their head comes off. You know, it's much more of a, you know, sort of a general curve, so to speak, of techniques, because everything kind of builds on it. So when we do our techniques, we're not leading towards, you know, devastating your opponent and, you know, going into overkill.
We have techniques called repeated devastation and backbreaker. Mm-hmm. And literally you spin the person around and you pull them off balance and you drop their spine onto your knee. Mm-hmm. And you go, you know, you pull them down onto your knee. And I've had, you know, I'm a big guy. And, you know, unless the person who's doing the technique is prepared to hold my weight, I've fallen. And just falling onto the person's knee without the additional force of the technique mm-hmm. took me out for 2 days.
Ow.
Yeah, oh, it hurts. And I can imagine full force, full power, deliberate. Man, that will mess your shit up. Mm-hmm. Damn, I bleep myself on my own show. I was avoiding one word and still came out with another.
You can blame me. I'm a bad influence.
Yeah, there you go.
And for my money, I think there should be, the techniques should always leave you a way out and leave you with a way to, you can either, you know, A, hurt them really badly, or B, not hurt them so badly. You know, I think there should always be a way out, a route to go, which, you know, again, is not to say that the technique, you know, can't escalate into something, you know, fairly heinous and fairly destructive. I mean, I even use the term just as you did, like, you know, I say destroy the foundation or destroy their balance or whatever, but it's directed, you know, it's purely for the, you know, the, you know, just so they know that you're trying to break their balance. You're trying to, you know, ruin their foundation. So they're off balance. But at no time, I mean, are we setting someone up for a specific technique that can do a lot of harm? There should always be, you know, a way out.
That is really nice. One of the things, and I really like that, American Kenpo does have that as well in some ways, because all of the techniques are designed to splice together. The term we use is graft. And that means that you may start the technique or start the defensive action with one technique, and in the middle of it, you may switch to another part of another technique, and then you may even switch to a third technique, because, you know, Grandmaster Parker, as a street fighter, knew that nothing ever happens the way you planned it, and it never happens exactly the way that you do when you train in the dojo. So all of his techniques were designed to mix and match. So you can take a black belt technique, and it perfectly meshes with a white belt technique, a yellow belt technique, or a purple belt. And you can actually start one and move seamlessly and just flows right into another one and right into another one. And actually, our forms, our katas, are not katas in a traditional sense that you would see in your style. Your Shorin Ryu, that's right?
Right.
Our katas are actually our self-defense techniques strung together.
Yeah, I remember you. We talked about that before. I thought that was a pretty interesting way to approach it.
Yeah, it shows flow and continuation and constant movement, and sometimes we do both left and right side of the same technique. And so it's a way of practicing and keeping the motion going and teaching the fundamental principle of it doesn't matter what you do as long as you move. Just don't sit there like a sitting duck. Mm-hmm. Do something. So the katas teach the flow and the movement. Mm-hmm. But we don't have a kata that's just a form unto itself for that isn't associated with a self-defense move.
Oh. Well, you know, and that's, you kind of bring up an interesting angle on that as far as, you know, set techniques, because, you know, I'm from the school that, you know, the kata doesn't have, it's not a set technique. It's, you know, a placeholder for a technique. So when we could do, you know, we do the kata, we break out the bunkai after. And what we do when we approach it is there should, again, always be the escalation. So, you know, like this, you know, first technique can be, you know, you're just closing the distance. You can be coming in for a sweep. You could be doing any number of things. And you can kind of move up and down the ladder according to whatever the situation is or whatever you feel you have to do. And but at any time, you should be able to back out of that because to get it, you know, kind of back to that topic is you're, in my mind, you know, limiting the student because you're driving them down this road of, okay, someone punches you. If you decide to use this technique and you go this way, it's going to end up with, they're going to have a broken arm or somebody's going to have a broken something. You know, somebody's going to get hurt and there's no way to back out of it and there's no way to change it. And so, you know, I don't think you shouldn't be teaching those kind of techniques if we're going to go back to should or shouldn't, because if you can't give them the flexibility, you know, and you don't have the flexibility to perform techniques where you can't keep yourself and unfortunately, you know, your opponent or your attacker or whoever safe, then the onus is on you and as you as a martial artist and you as an instructor to provide that, you know, safety valve.
Well, you bring up a couple of good points, but there's also one question that a lot of people are going to be asking is like, the guy attacked me. Why do I give a crap whether or not he can walk afterwards? And I tend to agree with it to a certain extent.
And we're probably at the exact same extent.
You know, you need to be concerned about legal and civil liability, which is something that is never discussed in the dojo that I've ever experienced. You always need to find that outside of the dojo.
Yeah.
And sure, yeah, the guy may have bitten off more than he could chew, but was it a drunken argument. The guy was just, you know, I mean, I know a lot of martial artists who have been in bars, and some of these guys have been in my instructors, and the guys, you know, for some reason wanted to prove himself and, you know, decided he's going to throw a punch at a Hapkidoist. And he just sidestepped, didn't even, I think he just touched his foot, knocked him off balance, and he was already a couple of sheets to the wind, and he went flying and rammed himself and you know, messed up his face pretty bad on the table as he fell. But no one saw the foot. So it was like, well, the guy just tripped and fell. I just stepped out of the way. And then in another case, and it's the worst thing you could ever do is to actually grab a Hapkidoist. That's just plain stupid. Somebody grabbed a Hapkidoist, and one of the first techniques that we're taught is for a wrist grab. You whip the wrist around to escape, to break the hold. But if you do it with enough force and speed on an unsuspecting person, it will break their wrist. So this guy did this, grabbed a Hapkidoist wrist. It was like, what? Who grabs people's wrists unless you're grabbing a child to, you know, as a come along? But he whipped it around and broke the guy's hand right there in the bar.
Yeah. Well, there you have it.
But there are two extremes there. There's the one, just step out of the way and let the guy fall over himself. And then there's the take an action and break the guy's wrist. Both are can, but which one should? And this is, I don't know if we're actually going to ever be able to answer this question, but it's something that we should consider as martial artists and people interested in self-defense.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that's kind of the, you know, that's the thing that you can't really teach somebody, because it's, to me, it's situationally dependent. And I know, I'm sure there are people out there right now who, like when we were talking about it, was, yeah, you just steamroll the person, you know, or whatever. But just like you say, there's times that legally, you know, morally, you know, that you, do you need to do that? And my answer is, yeah, there are times that you should do it. I mean, but again, it's all dependent on the situation, what you're doing, where you're at, you know, where you have to be, who's with you. There's, you know, any number of variables, and you can't teach them all. You can't train for them all. And you know, we've kind of talked about this before, is that there's a, you know, there's kind of an ego and whatnot in the martial arts where, and it was kind of when you brought up this topic, for us to talk about, you know, like how many times that we've heard people talking, you know, like, you guys just can't admit that, you know, you could just walk away. Why can't you just say, well, and then I'd walk away? But there seems to be a little hesitancy among martial artists, especially ones that, you know, really like to fight, or, you know, have, you know, a big fight background, let's say, that, you know, they just don't say like, and I can just walk away. I can do both, and I can escape. They just, you can call it ego. You can call it a pride. I don't know. There's something that just won't let them go, like, or I could just leave, yeah. You know?
I actually have walked away from more opportunities to fight than I can ever remember in high school and in college. And the strange thing is, I got a reputation for being a badass without ever having to fight anybody, because I would walk away. And it wasn't like, you know, I wasn't doing an ego, dude, you're not worth my time, you know, and making the guy feel small, because that's just going to escalate the situation. It was like, you know what, dude, I'm sorry. Let's just call it even. And then I would walk away. But I wasn't kowtowing. I wasn't being, well, I'm too big and strong and you're just a flea and you're not worth my time. It was the happy medium in between that. And I actually had people, because, you know, drunken high school parties, I actually had people come up to me the next day and thank me for not kicking the crap out of them the night before. Because people up afterwards say, hey, you know what? That guy, you know, has done this and this and this and this. He could have done this to you, but he didn't. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of reputation went around, and I was not seeking it. It just kind of happened.
Well, and that's not a bad way to go. I mean, that's probably because, you know, cooler heads prevailed. I mean, you know, you're a bigger guy. I'm sure that people knew you trained, you know, and whatnot. And probably the way you carried yourself precluded people from following up on it. I mean, you know, my thing was, I mean, I never, and then I'm kind of skewed because I don't know if the stars were all in alignment in my life, but you know, I've only been in like two fights in my life and, well, two fights in my adult life. And, you know, as a kid, that doesn't count. But since I've been a martial artist, and you know, I've been in a lot of places I shouldn't have been, you know, but you know, that kind of comes down to the same thing again. It's like, should I go down that street by myself when I'm all liquored up in this strange country that I don't speak the language, or shouldn't I? Yeah, I think I shouldn't. And then I'd go. So I think that...
I'm sorry, and then you'd go anyway?
No. Then I would not go.
Okay.
And then, of course, you know, maybe later after a few more beers, that might have been... But, you know, when I was in the Navy, we traveled in packs. So that was the other good thing. You know, should I go out by myself? No, I shouldn't. I should stay with my group. But
well, that depends upon whether or not you're traveling with a pack of Marines or a pack of Navy guys.
Well, you know, it's
a pack of Marines is just asking for trouble.
Well, yeah, and then there's the other thing, you know, like, you know, is someone going to get you into trouble? You know, who are you with? And you know, that's a whole other thing of should or shouldn't. You know, with the contextual thing, as well. You know, when we were somewhere in a foreign port doing whatever, it's like if we did this thing that you know that I'm more or less trained to do, I'm going to get in trouble, you know, and what ramifications is that going to hold for myself, for the boat, for the Navy, for America? You know, there's all those permutations, which also come back to a personal defense standpoint of, you know, what you choose to do, you know, doesn't just stop at you. You know, if you're a family man, you know, if you got a family to support, if you do something more than you should or more than you need to, it's probably, you know, is it should or shouldn't or need? What do you need to do? And, you know, where do you stop? Because in the heat of the moment, you may not be able to stop your training. And if you don't have the ability to, you know, if you don't have a technique to pull from, you know, that you can stop short of actually hurting somebody with, you know, you need to be able to see that, okay, I'm going down this road and I need to stop now, depending on the situation, and be able to identify that in a timely fashion before it goes too far.
Well, that requires a level of maturity, and that, unfortunately, really can't be taught.
That's true.
You can model it, but you can't teach maturity. That has to be, that only happens through self-discovery.
Well, and of course, this probably speaks to that too. Then, you know, from a personal protection standpoint, you know, it's probably behooves people to, and again, you know, it's the way a lot of martial art places are marketed, and they don't cater to this. But, you know, you should be looking for something that gives you not necessarily the responsibility or the maturity, but, I don't know how to say it. It's responsibility is what I say, is what I look at is, you know, it's like the, you know, the tagline for my, the tagline for my dojo is, practical martial arts for the everyday world, by which it means, you know, I'm not, you know, stumbling on a crime scene every day and having to, you know, fight hijackers as they, you know, try and take over the airplane. And, you know, I'm not, coming out of the drugstore and stumbling upon a band of ruffians breaking into my car. I live in the everyday world where really not that much goes on. You know, there's not cases of road rage busting loose. There's no one taking over my bus with a bomb. There's that stuff just doesn't happen. So the techniques that I teach are ones that, you know, give you a chance to ramp up to something, but also give you the context of like, okay, well, see how easy it is to do this thing. So to hurt somebody, it's going to be much easier, i.e. not so much that the technique is going to be so, you know, boss that it wipes them out, but it's just like, you know, well, this little bit of leverage here applies over here. And if you apply it over here, it's going to have a much more devastating effect than if you just do it right here and then leave. So I'm probably more... to bring it back to the topic, I'm probably much more in the the shouldn't camp of, you know, you shouldn't do this because you don't need to. You know, but there it is. It's over there. There, you know, let's practice it a couple times. Okay. Because if you, you should be able to get there quickly. You know, it shouldn't have to be a big convoluted thing, because the more convoluted it is, the more drawn in you get, the more, you know, the more you're forced down a certain path and unable to change it.
Let's switch a bit to children. Now, I know your younger student is 13. You don't really have kids in your class. In our dojo, we have a lot of kids. With the devastation that you can bring with American Kenpo, with the speed and the power and the direction the techniques take in terms of you're going to drop this guy in four or five moves. From the Kenpoists that I've spoken to that have been in street fights and bar fights, they rarely get beyond the second technique move in a technique, in a self-defense technique. Because the first move is so powerful that it usually just knocks somebody who's untrained right on their butts. I mean, again, going back to five swords, because it is the classic American Kenpo technique, the first thing is you step, when somebody swings at you, usually in this case it's a wide hooking punch. You know, that drunken swing that you see, which is extremely common for the untrained. You step into it. So your body mass and body movement is moving into theirs with a double block. The forward arm is high, and you're hitting at the bicep or shoulder, and then your second arm, the rear arm, is catching them between the elbow and the wrist. So you've got that full block. The people that I know that have used this in street situations, it has knocked the guy so far back the fight has been over. It literally, especially if the guy's already, you know, a little bit intoxicated, it sends them 10, 15 feet away, and they never get to do the next move because it's over. And one of our masters that is teaching right now, he's from Guatemala, and that's what happened to him. He got jumped by three guys when he was getting into his car. Again, classic parking lot scenario. Back's turned, distracted, get into the car, and that's when they jump you. They hit him a couple of times, and as soon as he got his bearing, each time he went to do a Kenpo technique against the attack, it was one strike down. And even if it was, he didn't even really hit anybody, it was the blocks. So the point of me telling about all that is, now what do we teach these children? So now we've got 4, 5, 6-year-olds, you know, all the way up. I mean, some of the kids are as young as 3 and a half, if they have the maturity to concentrate in class. What do we teach these kids? And it's a real issue. And the way that we've gone about it is to teach fundamentals, sparring, and then the katas. The kids don't actually get the self-defense techniques. We teach them the katas, and we work on the flow. And then if they stick around long enough and become a teenager and they can move on to the adult class, is when they start seeing how the katas are applied and are the part of a self-defense technique. So we've been teaching them a self-defense technique without teaching them self-defense technique.
Well, yeah. You know, I mean, that's the argument, or I guess not the argument, the direction that, you know, a lot of traditional martial arts take, and especially Okinawan kind of guys take, is, you know, getting that one really good, strong block in there, and that can end it. We had a guy in our class who he was a first degree black belt and had gotten just, he hadn't had it very long, and he was on the job and somewhere, and, you know, big roughneck union workers, and they were like, oh yeah, you know, you take karate here, block this, and just, you know, took a punch at him, and he blocked, and we blocked, you know, using our knuckles, and this block, you know, metal block or inside block, what, depending on your system. Anyway, so he blocked his knuckles, and he ended up giving the guy a pretty good lump on his arm. it was a good strong block, and the guy dropped his arm, and he's like, and so he swung again immediately after, and so he blocked the other way, crossed the center line and blocked the other way and did the same thing. And the guy was like, you know, like, hey, you know, you hurt me or whatever. Anyway, the guy stopped right there, you know. So the teaching the value of a good strong block with good mechanics and good form and everything else can do a lot, as well as one, you know, a good hard punch. You know, like I say, there's no first strike in karate, but, you know, where that, you know, first strike is, you know, what constitutes, what's a, you know, a counter, you know, which again, you know, kind of falls in the should or shouldn't. Should you have to, should you, you know, strike? Because if someone, you know, takes a swing at you and no one sees it, but your counter is a strike, then, and all they see is you hitting them, then, you know, from a legal standpoint, you might be in trouble. But
oh yeah, I mean, I was varsity water polo in high school, and that was one of the things we learned very quickly was it's the reaction to the strike, because, you know, water polo is basically a gang fight in Speedos, and so if somebody did something to you, if they hit you, they clawed you, they kneed you, they kicked you, whatever it was, they didn't get caught a lot of the time. It was their motion drew the eye of the referee, and then you reacting to it by throwing an elbow or doing whatever you were going to do and reacting to it got you ejected. So, and that's one of the things we also teach in firearm self-defense is the guy pulls a knife on you. If you pull your gun, all the witnesses aren't going to see the knife. They're going to see the gun. And they're going to call 911 and report you for pointing a gun at this poor, innocent person, because they don't see the knife. All they see is the biggest thing there, the second thing.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, that brings up a good point. So, I mean, as far as, you know, being a firearms instructor and stuff yourself, how do you guys, you know, approach that, or how do you approach that question? Should you or shouldn't you, or, you know, the escalation, how do you approach that?
I might refer people back to a previous episode on principles. There's so many factors. It's really hard. It's, you know, there are way too many variables just to say, what do you do? You know, what is the patent thing you do? And you really can't say that. It really depends upon the situation. But you need, the most critical aspect is to try to control the situation. Do not let it escalate. But at the same time, do not let yourself get hurt. And if the guy is going to stab you and he's being threatening and you feel that your life is in danger, by God, pull your gun and put it in his nose, you know, just do it. But then you have to be aware and have to be cognizant of the public relations that you're going to have to do afterwards to stop yourself from going to jail. My CCW, or concealed carry weapon instructor, said the first thing you have to do, you have to call 911, because everyone around you is going to report to the police that you and the criminal, the guy that you pointed the gun at, he's going to run away and call the police as well and report you for attacking him.
Right.
And years, literally years ago on the show, I talked about one of my teammates on my swim team. His name was Mike. This guy was huge. His nickname was Tsunami, because he was so big that, and he was a breaststroker. So when he popped up for the breaststroke, he created this huge wave of water in front of him. And it was really disruptive, because the waves were so big, it made it like swimming in the ocean when you're in the pool. He was on Santa Monica College campus waiting at the bus stop. Three guys came up and tried to mug him. And he beat the crap out of them and then picked up the park bench that he was on and hit them with it. He went to jail for 30 days because they convinced the police officer who took the initial report that they were the victims. So they claimed that he attacked them. And because he did not know how to speak to the police, he was probably saying, yeah, you know, I have no idea what he said, but whatever he said was wrong. And the reporting officer, you know, had him down as the aggressor, and these poor guys got hit with a park bench as being the victims. So they went to rob him, and he went to jail.
And so, you know, to tie it back into the topic, it's, you know, how do we say that? You know, well, obviously he probably shouldn't have used the park bench, you know, or should he have? I mean, was that something that, I mean, obviously, felt that was the thing to do, and, you know, dealing with multiple opponents and you know, tactically, that might have been a way to get around it. You know, or should he have just run? You know, that's...
Yeah, I mean, and this was 25 years ago, and we're armchair quarterbacking it without all the information. But all I know is the basics of the incident and the results. But the question, yeah, what should he have done? Obviously, what he did do was wrong. Was the park bench excessive force? Well, I don't know. Depends upon what you think, if he felt his life was in danger. But he obviously did not control the situation. I'm gonna turn this back, though, to kids. As a parent, what are you going to teach your child and at what time? Because a lot of the people that listen to the show have families, and it's one of the reasons why they listen to the show, because they're very concerned about protecting their families. Now, as a parent who's very into self-defense, I have this issue. At what point do I expose my youngest to the realities of criminals? At what point do I teach him various levels, and I'm talking about various levels, of protection? When I grew up, I had no choice. Due to my father's employment, his life was threatened by convicted criminals on a regular basis. So we grew up in a very secure household from the day that I was born. We had tons of security protocols. We were using passwords and codes and criminal awareness, you know, from as long as I have memory. I don't have that type of need. But at what point do I expose my youngest to that? You're a parent as well. Have you thought about that?
A little bit. I mean, you know, the thing about it is, my son now is, he's five, so he's kind of getting into it. I mean, he, like tonight we had a demonstration and he was there, and you know, he was telling everybody like, oh, I know karate, and he's starting to get jazzed into it. But yeah, he doesn't have the maturity for the techniques. It's one of the reasons why I tend not to teach kids, is because, you know, again, like I say, you know, I don't teach techniques that are, you know, so awesomely devastating that, you know, one touch, you know, knockout or, you know, DMOC or anything like that. I don't teach that. But for some things to be effective, for example, you know, we're talking about, you know, a strong block and a strong punch. Well, you know, a child can only block with so much strength, and a child can only punch so hard. Working on the assumptions and given the assumption that, you know, their form is correct and, you know, they have a firm grasp on, you know, their stance and body placement and blah, blah, blah.
But even if they do, I mean, the child doesn't necessarily have the dexterity to control it. It's for a lot of the kids, it's on or off. So it's either full power, full speed, or they're not moving.
Exactly. And that's where I'm getting at is, you know, that given, you know, if everything worked perfectly, do they have the maturity and the ability to dial it back? And then the flip side is, you know, do they have the maturity to understand that they don't have as much as they think they do? Because, you know, at the end of the day, you know, a lot of times mass works. I mean, you know, people can like say like, you know, they're awesome fighters and blah, 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 but it might just be that they're just the biggest mo in the room. And, you know, if, you know, like if I'm striking somebody who's 300 pounds, let's say, it's not going to be as effective as if I'm striking somebody who's 80 pounds. So I can use my mass, I can use all that stuff, but they can't necessarily use that. But there are techniques that we could teach them that would be more effective for them. But they're more dangerous to employ, they're more dangerous to teach, and they have bigger ramifications, you know. So as a child, yeah, I mean, you know, I don't want to teach them, probably, I don't want to teach them something that, you know, they're going to accidentally misuse to hurt them. I also don't want to give them a false sense of security that they're, you know, these walking death machines. So it's a fine line. And I kind of draw it back on that to taking it back to the art part of the martial art more so, and teaching the defense concepts from the sense of, you know, awareness and avoidance, which are always the big two that you and I both always talk about, and getting them to use their head and you know, use common sense, you know, again, coming back to should or shouldn't, should I go that way or shouldn't I go that way? Should I be with these people or shouldn't I be with these people? And work at it on that level until they reach a level of mental maturity where you can start showing them a few more techniques or a few more ramifications of this technique or a few more iterations of this technique that would be more appropriate, I guess, for lack of a better word. Because, you know, I mean, and again, I mean, it's my stance that, you know, by and large, the world that we live in doesn't require you to be able to, you know, snap somebody's neck, break their leg, whatever, in a defense situation. But they should probably know it in case they have to do it. But the point where you teach them, you know, I think is purely dependent on the child. I mean, from what I understand, when my instructor went to Okinawa and trained in Okinawa, he said, like, the kids there, the Okinawan kids there were like, awesome. And their technique was great. Their power was great. Everything was great. And I think it was probably just culturally, they were just more, you know, mentally ready to do the techniques at that level that, you know, American children at that age just aren't ready for.
Do you think it was because of early exposure and the fact that it was part of the culture?
I think it was, I don't think it was the early exposure of the culture. I think it was probably the seriousness of which they took it. And so from the cultural standpoint of that, I think so. I don't think it was because they, you know, were having kung fu fighting every day. I think it was just because that, you know, they just, you know, culturally they, you know, for lack of a better term, they learn better. They're more serious about it. And it was reflected in their technique. Whereas, you know, kids in the United States, maybe not so much. You know, maybe they're not, there's less of a drive to be serious about the instruction. And, you know, that is what it is. I mean, that's what we have to operate in. So
I can draw a parallel to that, I think, with the hunting culture in the United States. In certain areas of the United States, people grow up in and around hunting. Here in Los Angeles, I have to hide the fact that I hunt because there are people that I work with that were like, oh my God, you go out in the forest and you shoot animals and then you cut them open and you gut them and you eat them and you do that yourself? What type of sick bastard are you? I'm a hungry sick bastard because, you know, Bambi tastes good. But the people in the Midwest, no big deal. Everybody goes hunting. Or if you don't go hunting, you've been so around it that it's part of the culture. It's, you know, accepted. But out here, it's evil and vile and dirty and nasty, and beef comes wrapped in plastic at the butcher shop. And I'm not too sure about those butcher guys. They've got some pretty big knives and they cut meat all day. So culturally, I think it has a could have a significant influence on how you view and consider the various aspects of what could be a deadly art. Everyone has guns. They're all loaded. People go out, you know, shoot animals, tend not to shoot each other, and everyone comes home and had a great time. And it's, you know, coming of age, and it's, you know, you're camping and hunting, and there's nothing better. But out here, it's vile, it's evil, and it's got to be, you know, hidden away.
Yeah, well, that's true. And so, I mean, I think the way I look at it, especially from a teaching kids, and the way I'm going to approach it is, I'm going to approach it purely kind of on the surface value of, you know, here it is, here's the techniques, you know, here's the basic techniques, you know, and 25 basics, we do those, one steps, we do those, and it's going to be as near as I can tell. I mean, he hasn't really gotten into it yet, and I don't really have any kids to teach. It's just going to be, you know, here's the surface, here's the history, here's the content. I'm not really going to look at it any more deeply than the art of, you know, getting your form right, getting your, you know, good focus, good punch, good stance, good whatever. And it's just going to be an activity. It's not necessarily going to be something for personal protection, except for the fact that, you know, some of the stuff that they do can be used for personal protection. And that's going to be much more on a conceptual level of, you know, be aware, avoid what you're doing, you know, that.
Are you really going to be able to hold to that? I mean, I know so much cool stuff that is so much fun and it is so cool. I don't know if I'm going to be able to contain myself for the decade or more it's going to take for him to reach the maturity level to fully comprehend it. I think that is going to be a huge challenge because, you know, I'm constantly training. You know, I'm always going out. I'm always seeking out other instructors and new experiences, new ways of looking at self-defense, new ways of applying martial arts. And I use that term in the perspective of defensive techniques, whether it's empty-handed, weapon, firearm, it doesn't matter. I consider, you know, everything martial arts when it comes to that. And there's so much cool stuff out there. It's going to be, I think, frustrating not to share and overshare. And the other course, the other thing is, like, what if you scare them off? You know, there's too much push, and you could either, you know, grow up loving it or grow up hating it. You know, you've got the, you know, it's the whole cop thing, you know, come from a family of cops and you either become a cop or you become a criminal.
Well, yeah, you know, and from an instructor standpoint, yeah, I've known lots of martial art instructors who tried to get their family enthused in it and ended up, you know, kind of alienating them from the martial arts because of that. Yeah, you know, and again, there's a should or a shouldn't right there. Should you push it? Should you not push it? And I've kind of taken the hands-off approach of, you know, he knows I do it, you know, and he's now in the last, you know, year or so, been paying attention to it and kind of wants to come to a class, but he can't focus enough to really, you know, get past the warm-ups pretty much. And maybe the first couple of techniques before his mind is wandering. So no, I'm not going to push it. But I really think I'm going to try and keep it on a level of kind of the way I approach, martial arts in general is, you build the foundation and you build on top of the foundation. So for me, the foundation is going to be like, he's interested in it and he likes it from me. And I'm just going to kind of salt in the conceptual part of it. And though, I mean, yeah, I'm sure there'll be times where I'm going to go like, oh, I just want to show him this technique. But I mean, I think there is enough other information to provide them that it will achieve pretty much the same thing. And then I think that if, you know, as long as if they're a serious enough student, they'll kind of come to those things on their own, if that makes any sense. You know, I mean,
absolutely. I'm seeing some of that now already, although he's still quite young. He's seeing things that are hanging on my walls and asking questions about them, you know, swords and the belts and the certificates. And of course there are the dead animals, as my wife likes to call them. I like to call them trophies, including, you know, boar's skulls that we've taken from some of the animals that I've hunted and taken, and we bury them in the backyard for, you know, 2 years, dug them up, and they were all nice and cleaned. And so I have those sitting on the walls, and it's like, so what's that? And I was like, oh, that's a skull of a boar. It's like, oh. And it's like, you know, I shot him and ate him. I was like, you shot him and ate him? I said, yeah, actually, there's probably some of the sausage still left in the freezer. But your mother wouldn't let me feed it to you. We have a separate freezer for the game meat. It's perfectly safe, and he could mix it all you want. In fact, in a lot of ways, it's safer than some of the store-bought pork and things like that. But she just prefers it out in the freezer in the garage. But and more, won't let me cook it up and feed. Oh, she let me eat it all I want, but she won't let me feed it to him. I don't get it. But
what do you tell him? It was, you know, the boar was coming after me, and I did what I had to do.
Yeah.
So that's how you tie it back in
from the South Park episode.
Exactly. You know,
he's,
I was
coming
just,
right at me.
Exactly. There's nothing else I could do. Yeah, you know, I mean, and loading them up with that sort of moral compass, I think, is probably a big step towards giving them the ability to say should or shouldn't. Because, you know, I mean, if they have no concept of hurting someone else and the ramifications of hurting someone else, or the ramifications of you hurting someone else, it doesn't matter. I mean, you can show them, you know, the most benign techniques in the world, and if they, you know, don't care, and they can still hurt somebody. So, and then if you use, you know, show them the 5-point exploding heart technique, you know, but if they don't have the moral compass to not use that in every situation, then it doesn't help either. So I think that probably coming at it kind of in a, yeah, I mean, if you have the opportunity to ease into it slowly and build on it over time, then if they're responsible with their training and you're responsible as an instructor, or you have them training with the responsible instructors, they will come to define the line and when to cross it, or when they think they should cross it, or, you know, where the line is and what techniques are appropriate for that line. Because, I mean, the techniques that I teach are not, like I say, they're not in and of themselves, like, standalone. Well, there's a lot of the self-defense techniques. Like, even tonight, we were doing a certain technique, and, you know, they're doing the technique, and they would say, well, you know, this isn't working in that aspect. You know, I said, well, you got to kind of move your feet, or, you know, maybe you got to kick them a little bit, or, you know, but you don't have to kick them. You can just shift your body, and it's kind of the same thing. And there's, there are things that you can do to facilitate that technique. That technique will work in and of itself, and you can get away, but it may not work necessarily right now on this person this size or whatever. You'll have to do something else. So that other thing that you show them isn't necessarily like you poke their eye out. You know, it could be any number of other things. So I think you need easing up into it and giving them enough options, practical options, and easy to apply options, or simple to recall options, is probably better, because the rest of the stuff, they'll kind of find a lot of the I guess I should preface it this way. A lot of the super cool double secret techniques that I quote unquote know, most of them I came to on my own. I mean, and, I mean, I didn't reinvent the wheel or anything. It was just,
no, it's because your grandmaster didn't trust you. He felt you would usurp his throne and use his techniques against him. So he hid them from you. Well, and you were smart enough and crafty enough to figure them out on your own.
I did poison his older son and try and steal the scrolls, but he'd already moved them. Yeah. No.
Or perhaps the scroll case was just empty.
Or perhaps the answer is there is no answer. No, the a lot of the technique, I mean, you know, my instructor, I'm sure everyone says this about their instructor. My instructor was a walking death machine. My instructor was a bad man in his day, you know. I mean, and so he knows some stuff, and he knows how to do some stuff, but he never really, you know, taught me like, and this is, you know, and you rip their throat out. But, you know, I came to it by like, oh, okay, well, the body goes this way and this bends that way, and that's kind of soft there, and oh, I bet I can just kind of squeeze that, and you know, and
this is a little soft, I think I could squeeze it.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I can get my fingers in there, and it's, and you know, the body goes this way and all their weight goes here, and so yeah, it lands on your knee, and you know, just, you know, whatever it is, it doesn't matter what the technique is, but I came to it through the years of doing whatever it is, and usually because I could have I had enough training to understand that the body moved that way, and to move the body that way, and I would stumble across it or whatever it is. So that's another reason, kind of probably why I don't teach something in specific, because I don't really have a specific technique. It's like, oh, look, I'm here, and I can do this, whack, you know, and move on. And then, so then I may actually stop the class and go like, okay, look, when you get here, there's this thing and you can do this, you know, but I don't, you know, drive towards it. It just, it happens to end there, because really it has to be for us the way, and for the way I teach, it's where you end up. Well, okay. And you have to do something from there. You know, you can't necessarily guarantee that they're, what you're doing is going to drive them in this way and blah, 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 blah. So I think giving them enough basic solid information and a good foundation will allow them to get where they need to go to do a technique, if they need to do that level of technique, where it comes to the point is like, well, should I smash their knee and punch them in the throat, or should I just run away? You know, or should I just smash the knee and just keep going? You know, so I think it's probably a matter of training time and, you know, solid technique and being able to sneak up on the problem when it presents itself.
So what you're saying is that you hope that when you teach them how they can, that they know when they should.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, because it, just like me, I mean, and I'm going to, when I'm there and I'm in the situation, I will do what I think I should. But I've been in a few situations where, yeah, I could have done something, but I, you know, I de-escalated it instead, you know, or I just walked away, you know, or whatever it was. So,
but that's the point I want to make. You could have done any number of things to that person, but you right. made the choice of whether or not you should, and you said, I should not, and
right.
walked away. But, I mean, I know that we are not going to come to a definitive conclusion on this, but I think it's...
No, we're not leaving here until we answer the question. I mean, I'm going to put the phone down, but you stay on until we finish this up.
Yeah. But the point of the whole episode this week is to at least have the discussion. You need to think about it, because the point is you can do all sorts of things and you can train to do all sorts of things. But before you actually do them, you need to think about whether they should be done. And I think that separates the thug from a martial artist. And somebody yeah. who's truly interested in self-defense versus being a bully.
Right. Yeah. You know, I mean, tonight, and actually, that's kind of a really important point, or because tonight we have, I got a couple guys that I train with that were like wrestlers in high school. So they really like to go to the ground, and, you know, I'm tall and fairly thin and whatnot, and I don't go to the ground because I can't wrestle well. And so that was kind of one of the things that we were talking about someone shooting in on you. And, you know, one of the things I talk about is like, well, you know, if you choose to, you know, go to the ground, now, before everyone starts sending email, sometimes you can't choose. I got it. Noted. But if if the technique that you choose to do drives you to the ground and you end up with a wrestler who is more adept on the ground than you, then you have, you know, chosen badly.
Chosen poorly.
Yes, yeah. You have chosen poorly.
Yes. Because and that was one of the biggest eye-openers that I discovered when I was first starting jiu-jitsu was, if you go to the ground and you have no idea what you're doing, and the other person has any little bit of training, you're done. You're screwed. Which is the only reason why I strongly recommend people do ground fighting as well and ground defense. They need to get familiar with it, because MMA is way too popular these days, and you're going to come up to somebody who's gotten at least a little bit of training. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have any either, it's bad. Really bad.
Well, you know, one of my guys, he's 18, so he's young, he's strong, he wrestled, and so when we wrestle, he usually, you know, and I say with all humility, as a fourth degree black belt and karate. He eats my lunch when we're on the ground because he has a far more broad skill set than I do on the ground, unless I start striking or doing.
Don't go into rules on me.
Exactly. Well, you know, I mean, it's just it's not rules. It's as soon as and I have a judo guy with me, and whenever we go to the ground, he keeps forgetting that I can do something other than judo stuff. So, and he actually likes it because he's like, oh, I forgot about that. I'm like, exactly. But I enjoy a good role as much as the next person. But the point I was making with those guys was like, if I have the choice not to go to the ground, I am not going to the ground with this guy. You know, because if someone is shooting in on you like that, chances are they probably have some sort of training anyway. So if they know how to do it, if they're good enough, it's obviously might not make much of a choice. You may not have a choice. You're going down anyway. But you have the choice, do you let it get to that point where they're going to shoot in on you? Do you have the choice, should you let that get to that point where you're going to encounter somebody who has a different skill set than you have? And there's nothing you can do. So from there we went, okay, now look, now here's how some ways to get out of that. And, some ways are more strident than others. And so, we kind of talked about those, but, I didn't give them a, when someone comes in, you do this and just destroy them, because you can't necessarily always say that anytime someone does that, that's what you're going to want to do. You're not always like you're talking about the five swords. You're not always going to want to do that technique every time someone comes at you that way. You need to have a measured response. And, how broad you cut that measure is purely dependent on the situation. And if you have, and also probably I think as a responsible martial artist, you are remiss if you don't seek out the measured response. The ego of, I can do this and I'm such a tough guy. I can break a brick with my hand. So I'll just hit him in the head but you don't need to do that. If you can get away with not doing that, why not just get away with not doing that?
Absolutely. I was just thinking that when you were saying that, hit him in the head. I had a private session with Soke Tak Kubota a couple weeks ago, 1 hour private session with him on Kubotan. And it was absolutely amazing. And I thought I understood Kubotan, but 1 hour with him took me places I never knew you could go. And I'm going to have some further training with him and actually become a certified instructor under him. But one of the things that he mentioned with the Kubotan, and for those that don't know, the Kubotan, everyone should know if they listen to the show, is a six inch stick, about 1/2 inch in diameter. And it's just either hard plastic, metal, or just wooden rod. The things you can do with that innocent looking little stick just are unbelievable when applied properly. But one of the things that he brought up was when we're striking to the head, he was like, strike here, strike here. You can do this, but you shouldn't do this. And one of the things he talked about that was a hammer fist strike with a Kubotan to the temple. Because he said, that will probably kill the person. And I was like, wow, okay. And boy, yeah, it... That 1 hour session completely changed my attitude towards the Kubotan in terms of how it's applied. It really blew me away. But then again, he is a legend for a reason. I still remember the couple of private lessons that I had with Grandmaster Han. Man, because with Grandmaster Han, you showed up and you never, if you had a private lesson with him, you never asked what you were going to learn. You never set up the lessons. Hey, could you work with this on me? No, when you set up a private lesson with Grandmaster Han, you showed up and he taught whatever he felt like it. And one time we did it and he felt like teaching sidekick. So we spent an entire hour on nothing but sidekick. And after the end of that hour, my sidekick has never been better. It was just, it's you know, when you're at that level of legendary instructor, no matter what they teach, no matter what you've experienced, no matter how many years you have, you're going to learn something new. That's why they're legends. And I've been blessed with being able to study under several in my martial arts career. But yeah, it was unbelievable. Both of those men were just unbelievable.
Well, yeah. And I think it's kind of interesting that, you know, the way he demonstrated, you know, hit here, hit here, hit here, but, you know, you probably shouldn't hit here, you know, and that's probably the way to go. It's kind of the way I look at it is like, you know, if you're demonstrating, it's like, okay, now this is bad. You know, this is the bad thing, but there it is, you know, and so now, you know, and you remember it, right? You know, you it's in your head now.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Everything in that lesson weeks later is still crystal clear.
So, but I'm saying, like, you know, going forward, like a year from now, 2 years from now, you in your head now have, if I have the Kobutan and they're in this position and that target is there it is. And you know it. You know, it's in your head. It's but he didn't really necessarily go over it. Probably didn't practice it. You know,
no, he showed once. He said, here, here, and here. And he said, this you can, but probably shouldn't. Right. And so in my mind, that is now forever and forever will be a lethal force attack with the Kobutan.
Right.
And so that will be, to me, is equivalent to firing a pistol. It's only in the gravest extreme, under absolute threat of death or grave bodily harm, that will ever strike that position.
Right. Yeah. And so, you know, it was taught to you, but it wasn't taught to you. It was shown to you within the context of all this other stuff that you can do. And, you know, and so now you have a context for it of, like, I can do all this other stuff and I can also do that. And, you know, so then I think, to keep it, you know, back on the topic, is for you, now you can go, like, okay, I can do all this other stuff. I have that guy there when the situation warrants it and I feel it. And again, it comes back, you know, to the context, the situation, you know, it's a personal choice. It's like, and you can also do that. And, but you have to live with the ramifications of whatever that is. And, I don't think you can teach someone, you know, how to handle the ramifications of doing that. Name your technique of something that's going to be so devastating that it would, you know, change one or two people's life if something happened. So, you know, but teaching it within that context is probably the way I would approach it, is, you know, here's all the other stuff. Oh, and there's that. But I mean, was there wasn't any great change in, of course, we're talking in the context of using the Kobutan. So I guess there wasn't any great, like, you can do this, or, you know, change the body like this, and then you can do that. Or it was basically, he was standing in one spot going, here's all the targets.
He was just standing there and pointing out various targets on the head that you could strike.
Yeah. So, I mean, he wasn't like, you know, okay, I'm going to, you hit him here and then this moves, and you hit him here and then this moves, and then you can hit this and his entire body will explode.
No, it was nothing like that. It was like, you know, when you use the device at the head, you want to strike here, you want to strike here, you swipe here, you can strike here, but it will probably kill him. So you don't want to do that.
Right. So, you know, like tonight I was talking to the students doing the demonstration. And I said, like, you know, here's the block and punch, here's the block, punch and kick. But look, all of these techniques and the following techniques also allow you to back out of it and run away, you know, to whatever degree. Was, you know, there's always a back door. There's always a way out. There's always a direction to go. You know, there's never like a, like, if you're going to perform this technique, you know, you have to set it up in such a way to do it. And so, and I don't ever want to teach that way. I don't ever want to say like, okay, now here's the, you know, you do these techniques to lead up to the fact that you can, you know, make their entire spine, you know, fall off their butt. You know, whatever it is, you know, I don't ever think as a martial arts instructor that I want to, you know, set someone up in this, you know, as it were, to fail. And which in the failure in this part is hurt somebody so bad and because they had no choice but to do it. You know, they need to have the choice. And so, you know, it's when you say should or shouldn't, it's like, you know, as an instructor, I shouldn't be teaching, giving somebody no choice. I shouldn't be giving them the ability to defend themselves without being able to preserve themselves, you know, it's easier to hurt somebody than to walk away sometimes, but it's usually easier just to get away.
Or avoid.
That's right. Yeah.
All right. Well, I think we've covered the subject matter pretty broadly, and I really appreciate the time that you spent with us sharing in the conversation.
It's always nice. And this is one of the reasons why I was like talking to you and talking about stuff like this and talking about things like this on our show is because it doesn't necessarily have to have an answer. It's just, it's questions that as martial artists or, you know, defense instructors or whatever, these are questions that need to be asked and need to be talked about and need to be covered. And so it's good that you're getting these out here and, you know, you're getting the discussion going about it.
Cool. Thanks. And if they want to reach you and listen to your show, what do they do?
Well, they can always go to, they can email me at karatecafe@gmail.com. And they can email, well, that's the course of the show. And then they can just listen to the show at karatecafe.com. We have a forum that people can join and put their opinions and whatnot, create topics, or there's a link to the show and they can listen to all the past shows.
Great. And I definitely recommend everyone avail themselves of the opportunity because it's a good show.
Oh, thanks, man.
And they even have this thing called a mini-sode.
Oh, yes. That it was inspired by greatness. Inspired by greatness, sir.
Yes, and of course, I stole it from somebody else. So what goes around comes around.
That's right. See, life is a cycle. Yeah, I mean, we started doing those just because, you know, scheduling shows are kind of hard because, you know, we had a three-man crew and, you know, the mini-sodes are great because we just, something pops in my mind, I can record an episode, put it out. I mean, I did one today, this afternoon at work. Took a little break at work, recorded it, and I'll probably have it out in a day or two. So,
oh, awesome. Look forward to listening to it. But it's also good, I think, you know, for you to come on a real show and get some real exposure.
Oh, well, thank you. Wait a minute. You know that should or shouldn't you? Oh, I think you're in the shouldn't right now.
Oh, really?
Now.
Okay. All right.
No, yeah. Well, you know, at least we're brave enough to go live. That's all I'm going to say.
Oh, yeah. And you guys were first.
Well,
although I've got like three times as many shows.
Well, you know, sure. If you want quantity over quality, that's what, you know, folks, it's all good, clean fun. I really respect Alex. I love coming on the show. I love him when he's on our show. It's a great podcast. The live thing is just, it's kind of a lark, and it's really mostly just because we can record and, you know, it's two birds with one stone. We can record the show and we can, you know, maybe hit an audience, and we've had, you know, five or six people listen live. So including yourself. You know, it's just kind of a fun thing, but it's always rife with some sort of technical difficulty anyway. So,
Such as the internet and technology.
Exactly. But yeah, we love it. I know we have a lot of people that listen to your show and our show, so including each other. So
it's rather, making it sound rather incestuous.
And that's one of the great things about martial arts is, you know, we're one big brother / sisterhood. So, you know, it's important for everyone to talk to everybody. I mean, and be, you know, fairly civil about it. For the most part.
A little incivility, or whatever the word might be, is still fun occasionally.
Yeah.
Well, thanks again for coming on the show. It was great. Loved having you.
thing. Thanks for having me on.
When every moment matters and a life is saved, when someone gives blood, when a hand reaches out, that moment when heartbreak turns to hope, you're there through the American Red Cross. Down the street, across the country, around the world, you help save the day. Every day. Your support truly matters. You can help today. Visit redcross.org.
Welcome back. Thanks again to Paul Wilson for joining us this week. You can find links to the Karate Cafe podcast in the show notes. And that will do it for this week. You can follow my daily tips on Twitter and Facebook. On Twitter, I am Practical Def, and Facebook is Practical Defense. If you have any tips you'd like to share with everyone, a comment on a show, or if you would like to suggest a topic for an upcoming episode, write into podcast@alexhaddix.com. I'd love to hear from you. Until next time, stay aware, stay safe. Oh, the sacrifices I make for my listening audience. Practical Defense is a member of the Gun Rights Radio Network at gunrightsradio.com. And that does it for this episode. Thank you for downloading and listening to the Practical Defense podcast. For questions, commentary, and topic suggestions, send an email to podcast@alexhaddix.com. That's podcast@alexhaddix.com. And if you ever want to train with me, look me up on the web at alexhaddix.com.